This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
On our current path, Southeast Asia will suffer through 300 days a year with a heat index exceeding 41 degrees C, 300 days above almost 106 Fahrenheit. People may survive, but crops feeding billions may not. Can we develop plants for a hotter world? Dr. Stephen P. Long is part of a group of scientists with the new paper, Safeguarding Crop Photosynthesis in a Rapidly Warming World. Born in the UK, Long is professor of plant biology and crop sciences at the University of Illinois. He is also visiting professor in plant sciences at Lancaster University and at Oxford in the UK. As Wiki says, his work published in Science proved that photosynthesis can be manipulated to increase plant productivity, an idea once considered the holy grail of plant biology. From Champaign, Illinois, Stephen Long, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for your interest.
Let's break this down as you do in your paper. First, we assess the situation of agriculture and food. Then we can at least peek into the complex world of plant engineering. You've been engaged in this for years, and I don't think it's just for the intellectual challenge or some corporate profits. Is it fair to say your team, led in this case by Carl Bernacchi, see developing heat as a really serious threat to human food in the future?
Absolutely. The rising temperatures are a major threat, particularly the fact that it isn't just the average temperatures rising, but the frequency of extreme heat waves, which can be really damaging to crops, particularly in, obviously, the warmest parts of the globe, but even in temperate zones, we're seeing heat damage to crops.
Yes, in my garden, I can be having a good year, but if I get 4 days of extreme heat and the plants basically either stop growing or die off, then it doesn't recover even if the good climate comes back for the rest of the fall.
Yes, and of course that is what is happening for our crops and will be increasingly as we go forward.
Millions of farmers have already experienced this in places like Pakistan and India and parts of Africa. Well, look, in my greenhouse, Stephen, plants stop growing around 95 degrees Fahrenheit. That's what I've seen anyway, around 35 C. Are there different thresholds of temperatures, like an upper limit for plant growth before actual damage from the heat?
If temperature exceeds 45 degrees Celsius, then there's usually irreversible damage. But depending on the crop, that can occur at considerably lower temperatures.
So the paper talks about a critical threshold of 40 degrees C, 104 Fahrenheit for some plants, or 45 for others, before what you call irreversible losses. Now, does that mean a loss of growth or a loss of plant cells or perhaps the death of the plant itself? What do you mean by irreversible losses?
Well, that is damage to the photosynthetic apparatus of the plant. So the way the plant gains its carbohydrates, everything that makes the plant up. And obviously, if that process is damaged irreversibly, then the plant can no longer grow and maintain itself.
How do high temperatures interfere with photosynthesis?
Two effects. One is that they damage critical enzymes, particularly an enzyme that activates and maintains the activity of an enzyme we call Rubisco. This is the enzyme which, in all plants, assimilates carbon dioxide into carbohydrates. So it's the most abundant protein on the planet, and it's sort of key to everything that drives the biosphere and provides our food. The second effect that we can see is that as temperature rises, the drying power of the atmosphere increases exponentially. So at these high temperatures, water is poured out of the plant at a very high rate. And so we're compounding the effects of temperature with also desiccation.
It's counterintuitive, but there can be too much solar energy for photovoltaic panels to produce properly. What do plants do when there is just too much light?
Yes, evolution has given plants a mechanism to defend itself against too much light. And without that mechanism, the chlorophyll in the leaf will absorb light energy, and the excess energy can actually start to damage the photosynthetic apparatus. So what has happened during evolution is plants have developed a method by which that excess light is then converted to heat and lost harmlessly from the leaf. And we call that sort of a photoprotective mechanism.
And human sweat to cool down our skin. I gather plant leaves use a similar process, but talk to us about the bottlenecks of interior water management in plants when a heat wave arrives.
Yes, if plants have sufficient water, what they can do is they have pores in the leaf which allow carbon dioxide to enter, and as it does, water escapes. Now, the leaf can cool itself by opening those pores wider so that more water is evaporating, and that cools the leaf surface. There are two factors here. One is that, if you like, the pipes which connect the stem to these pores in the leaf, do they have enough capacity? And a number of plants, they don't, so they reach a point where they simply can't supply the pores, the stoma in the leaf, with enough water. The other factor, of course, is that in many situations, there just isn't enough water in the soil. So a plant will normally respond to drought by actually closing its stomata to maintain what water is left, or making sure its tissue is not killed by desiccation. And of course, if there's drought, then the leaf cannot cool itself.
We've already smashed long-standing heat records around the world, and scientists predict more and more extreme heat waves. Now, one abstract for your new paper says, quote, protective measures within plants can be induced by growth at elevated temperatures, but not from the sudden temperature elevation of heat waves. Well, that sounds like science and biotech may not be able to save crops from big heat waves. What do you think?
There are protective measures which will typically give a plant maybe 3 or 4 degrees Celsius more tolerance. And if temperatures rise gradually, these processes are induced. If it's sudden, as you say, the damage can occur before this protection even arises. And one thing that biotech can do is to add means to stimulate that production more rapidly, or essentially have that protection expressed all of the time.
Well, getting to the solutions, let's go back to a 2016 breakthrough paper in Science you worked on. The title is Improving Photosynthesis and Crop Productivity by Accelerating Recovery from Photoprotection. How were you able to, quote, improve photosynthesis?
Yes, as we were discussing earlier, when a leaf receives more light energy than it can use in photosynthesis, it induces this photoprotective process, which converts the excess absorbed energy into heat. Now, when a leaf goes into the shade, for example, as a cloud crosses the sun, or as it becomes shaded by other leaves above, and in a dense crop canopy, this is occurring all of the time. When it goes into the shade, this photoprotective process continues for many minutes. And now the leaf could use all of the light it's receiving in photosynthesis, but it is dissipating quite a lot of that energy in this photoprotective process unnecessarily. So together with colleagues at University of California, Berkeley, we identified three genes which were coding for proteins which, if we upregulated them, we believe would speed up this process. And so that's what we did. And indeed, it did speed the process up. It meant that the crop photosynthesis was more efficient, and we saw more productivity.
Well, the crop in question was tobacco, and I have to ask, why would a team choose to boost productivity of tobacco? Is it a handy test plant?
Yeah. The only reason for using tobacco is that it's very quick to genetically modify. It's very easy to genetically modify tobacco. Then because it produces a large amount of seed, you can quickly move to a trial in the field. And you can do that within a year. For crops which we care about, like soybean, cowpea, wheat, etc., that is a 3 or 4 year process and considerably more expensive. So we use tobacco as our guinea pig. You know, does this really work in the field situation with a real crop, but obviously not one that we care about for food production?
In the new paper in Science, published June 12th, your group evaluates 4 possible doorways into changing plant capabilities. And the first is modifying surface energy balance. That sounds pretty technical. Could you give us an example?
Yes, for example, you know, if you look at different plants, maybe in your garden, you see some of them have leaves which look a bit white. You know, that's because they've got the surface of the leaf has hairs or waxes which refract the light and cause it to reflect. So those leaves will be cooler than the dark green leaves, for example. And we know in a number of our major crops there is variation in this reflectivity. You know, we've been modeling this and we realize that, you know, if you're considering the hotter world, though, although you're reflecting some of the light away, which you might want to use in photosynthesis, you're cooling the leaf. And so the net benefit is greater by making it more reflective. Another change you can make is to make the leaves more vertical. You know, if you look at, say, a modern wheat field, you might see 6 layers of leaves. Now, the upper layer of the leaf is absorbing most of that light, and you know, much of it can't actually use in full sunlight. If you make the leaves more vertical at the top, then more of the light can penetrate down to those shaded leaves, and the heat load on those upper leaves is less. So you're spreading out the heat load, and the average temperature is therefore lower, and those upper leaves are less likely to be damaged by heat. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I quite understand it. I have seen this in some of my garden plants that I'll have 2 varieties, and one, the structure is sort of wide open to grab all the sunlight directly overhead, and others are a little more protective and suspicious. So I have seen this. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor Stephen Long from the University of Illinois. Dr. Long is an acknowledged expert in plant physiology and photosynthesis. So you also looked into improving the heat tolerance of enzymes within the plant, and frankly, without a degree in botany, it's hard to follow that discussion. Can this avenue to help plants survive heat be explained in common language?
Yes. One of the key enzymes is the one which actually maintains the activity of the carboxylase Rubisco. That is the enzyme which captures carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Now, the enzyme which activates Rubisco, we call it Rubisco activase, is very temperature labile in most crops. Yet we know, for example, cacti can function at a much higher temperature. So what scientists are trying to understand is, well, what is different about their activase that allows that to function at a higher temperature? And what we're starting to see is there may be specific components of that protein which we could then alter in the crop protein. So that would be the one way to address this. important vulnerability of photosynthesis.
Of course, the time-tested solution to find better plant varieties is crossbreeding, observation, and selection. Is that going to be enough, and is it going to be fast enough to solve what might be a disastrous food crisis when temperatures go beyond crop tolerances?
One of the areas that we've got limited information about is, what is the variation within, you know, all of the varieties of a crop and its relatives, the relatives that have been crossed with it? Where we have got information suggests there could be quite a lot of variation there that could be exploited in conventional breeding. It still takes maybe 10 to 15 breeding cycles to really have something that can get into a farmer's field. So time is short. And the major problem there is that generally there's been a rundown in the number of plant breeders in the world. Plant breeding capacity has diminished for our crop plants. Except, of course, in the multinational companies, but they're, of course, focused on the crops which deliver a large profit, which is primarily North American corn, to a lesser extent soybean, whereas we really need to see progress in wheat and rice and the crops that are very important in tropical areas, such as cowpea, which is a major protein source in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. So there is certainly an opportunity there which needs to be exploited, but it does need far more capacity to be built in. Essentially, it needs more investment in plant breeding, more investment in the training of plant breeders, and giving them the modern facilities which can really speed up the whole process. Now, when it comes to genetic modification, if a crop is transgenic, i.e. you've introduced foreign DNA to make that crop more temperature resistant, then even in countries which accept transgenic crops, such as the United States, Canada, now Nigeria and Africa, for example, Australia, Argentina and Brazil, even in those countries, there's a very challenging regulatory network that you have to work through. I mean, it costs billions to work through that for just one change. And again, it would probably be 15 years, if successful, before anything is in a farmer's field. Now, there is another factor, and that is now gene editing, where obviously in evolution, you're getting mutations occurring all the time, where one amino acid and protein has been changed. And what we can now do is, with what is called gene editing, precisely make those modifications. So you're not bringing in any foreign DNA after you've made that modification. And a number of countries are now accepting that as being non-transgenic. That is a faster process, and you might expect to deliver something on about the same time frame as conventional plant breeding. But none of this is going to be fast. And although the opportunity is there, it isn't going to happen at the scale we need it without far more attention being given to the great concerns we have ahead.
As you know, Stephen, many people distrust or fear biotechnology. How do you, as experts in the field, assess risk and protect against misadventure or unintended consequences?
Yeah, governments, together with the NGOs, which have been against biotechnology, have developed these very rigorous frameworks where you have to prove that this biotechnology won't spread where it's not wanted, that the proteins you're now producing are safe, they don't have any toxicity. So it's really far more rigorous control than we have on conventional breeding, where you could take a gene from a crop ancestor, that may be an allergen, could be slightly toxic, put it into a crop, and that doesn't need to be tested. necessarily. So the controls around biotechnology are way tougher than they are around anything we're doing conventionally. And of course, if we look at everyday life, I mean, for example, billions of people around the world are on insulin. That is a biotech product entirely. You know, the human gene has been put into a bacterium, which makes the protein, and that is what goes into your insulin. So it's actually far safer than what was being done before, where we were using, for example, insulin from pigs rather than the exact human form.
Yes, I particularly worry about little plastic bits getting into my brain and all of that. None of that is regulated either. Now, suppose a lab creates a new variety of rice that can withstand extreme heat waves and still yield a good harvest. How would that be distributed, and can it reach even poor farmers?
Yes, we have a very good example of that. What was happening with climate change is that rice, of course, is an aquatic plant. Its roots are in, you know, the base of the plant is in water, the top is in the air. But with climate change, what was happening is we were getting more and more severe floods, which essentially drowned rice fields. So the whole crop was submerged. And rice cultivars cannot or could not survive submergence for more than a couple of weeks. So farmers' crops were killed, and this was many of the poorest farmers had the fields which were most likely to get flooded. Now, looking at a series of rice cultivars, scientists discovered a gene which actually protected the crop against this. And they tested this by transgenically taking that gene and putting it into a flood-intolerant cultivar and showing they could make it resistant to this flooding. So what they then did was, okay, take the line which had the gene, which made the crop flooding tolerant, and then cross that with many of the cultivars which were being used across Southeast Asia, particularly by poor farmers. And this got into seed systems. It was available to farmers without any cost to them for the technology. And it was adopted very quickly. And today, most of those crops are protected against this flooding event. So we do have an example where once you've got something that is really good, you can then get it into the seed systems, you know, where the farmers buy their seed, and that becomes available. There's a very good example in Nigeria as well, where scientists from Australia and Nigeria were working together to put a gene into cowpea that would make it resistant against an insect which would bore into the pod and basically destroy a farmer's crop. And again, that became the vet and is now in the seed systems in the country, and farmers are taking that on and buying that rapidly. And again, this is one where there is no charge for the technology to the farmer. So we do have some good examples, but we need many, many more of those. We won't really get them without having more plant breeders to work with the biotechnologists and more resources put into this, particularly where it's most needed.
Well, I think part of that is not to abandon the field to corporations who are looking for quarterly profits and keeping up public funding, which is in danger in some countries.
Yes, I mean, one of the things we've learned from really corporate activities, if we look at North American corn, in the past 50 years, its yields have more than doubled. And that is a lot of that, of course, are technologies which did come from the public domain that have been used and developed by these corporations to get more productive maize. So, it does give us an example. When enough effort is put into it, you could improve the other crops that we really need to be improved. So it is really just a question of, investments and effort.
Everyone knows the real solution is to stop burning fossil fuels on a super emergency basis, but there is no sign of that happening. I sense you want to help in the world as it is with your work. Stephen Long, what keeps you going?
What keeps me going is the fact that we can see that there are opportunities to future-proof our crops, and discovering those opportunities, trying to help get them to where they're really needed, is really what keeps me going. I mean, I'm fascinated by the mechanism underlying all of this, of course, but you know, that's been my career for 50 years. But using the discovery we've made around all of these mechanisms, and of course with the other scientists working on this issue over the world, and then using that for the good is what keeps me going. It's ironic, really, you know, the United States has withdrawn huge amounts of its US aid funding, which was particularly supporting this in sub-Saharan Africa. And, you know, and I think the UK has also withdrawn quite a bit of its funding because it needs to shore up its defences. You know, and I think the world is just not aware of the impending food crisis. Well, I say impending. You know, 10% of the world is starving at the present time. And that isn't just because of conflicts. You know, that is simply that in many parts of the world, people just cannot produce enough food, and they can't afford to buy it from elsewhere.
From the University of Illinois, we've been speaking with Dr. Stephen P. Long. Among his many positions, Stephen is director of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation project called Realizing Increased Photosynthetic Efficiency Project, or RIPE. Steve, we appreciate you taking time to talk with us.
Thank you, and thank you for your interest and for getting the word out about this very important problem facing the world, at a time when I is really focused on many other issues.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.